Hello, I'm Rupert Sheldrake. I'm here with Mark Vernon for another of our talks. Hello, Mark.
Hi there, Rupert. Nice to see you again.
Mark, this is I would like to continue our last conversation. In our last conversation, we were talking about your wonderful guide to Dante's Divine Comedy, the book. Perhaps you've got a copy that you could show us.
Oh, yes, yes, I can. I have one placed handily nearby. Yes. Thanks very much indeed.
Very good.
Shortly to be out as an audio book too, actually. As we speak, I've just uploaded the audio files, and so they need to be checked and so on. But with luck, around Christmas time, 2021, they will be available.
Read by you?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, last time we talked, we got halfway through the Inferno, the descent into hell, the Inferno. And we couldn't go further because I'd only got halfway. Since we last talked, I've completed that journey to the very depths of hell, with you as my guide, guiding me through, with Virgil guiding Dante. So it's slightly Virgil and then you are perfect guides for this journey. And I read it with increasing fascination, because what these scenarios there show, and what you help us to understand, partly because you're not only a great scholar, but also a psychotherapist, so you actually deal with personal problems in a way that I don't, for example. What you show is that the punishments that people are undergoing in the Inferno are not kind of arbitrary things sort of vengefully imposed upon them, but rather they're trapped in their own addictions or in their own obsessions. And so there's a sense in which the punishment fits the crime, because people are simply trapped in their habitual ways of being. And the further down we go into the Inferno, the kind of trapping seems different. And you know, you've got a much bigger overview than me, but in the earlier parts, it's some of the things that people are trapped in are being in love with love itself, as we discussed last time. But these are more serious ways of being trapped. They're more intellectual, in a sense, or more to do with the spirit, or more to do with dishonesty or cheating or whatever. Would you say there's a kind of gradation as you go down into hell of the things in which people are trapped?
Yeah, for sure. So a rough guide is that in the upper circles of hell, people are mistaken. So we talked last time about how people are mistaken about love and can get trapped by love rather than liberated by love, essentially when they feel there's an object of their love that they must have and hold to satisfy that love, rather than realizing that love is a pathway that is expansive and ultimately leads to an understanding of all reality. So that's the kind of mistake, a kind of ignorance, if you like, that people suffer from in the upper circles of hell. But as you go lower, people become more actively and deliberately engaged in the kinds of ways of life that trap them, and so they become more stuck, as it were. They refuse to be enlightened by the light that might show up their mistakes as they become more committed to their way of life. I mean, there's a rather wonderful moment when they pass one soul who is glued to the ground, can hardly sit up. And part of the idea there is that he's become trapped by spiritual gravity that's dragging him down, and so isn't at all alert to spiritual levity, which was the traditional way of understanding the rising force that ultimately leads us towards the divine. But for a moment notices that Dante is living, which is a shock in hell, and sort of squints, but then just falls back on the ground. And that's one moment that captures a lot of the sense of the people in the lower circles of hell, that even when life and light is right in front of them, they have become so committed to their own way of life that they can't respond. And that is their deeper predicament. You know, it's a bit like the difference between someone you might meet who's made a mistake and done a bad thing, but has remorse, as opposed to someone who has done a bad thing and is utterly committed to the evil. And so you feel, my goodness, I don't know how they can ever change.
Yes. Well, some of them undergo appalling punishments. Like, there's sort of a whole lot of people up to their neck in a kind of ditch full of shit. And those are flatterers. What's going on there? Was that so sort of saying that what came out of their mouths was, I mean, why are they trapped in the way that they're trapped?
Yeah, well, I have reached for a bit of Freud, actually, to understand this. You know, Freud's a bit of a mixed bag, and some of his ideas haven't really stood the test of time, but some of them have. And the link between flattery and excrement was one that Freud noticed as well. And he put it down to the childhood experience when you're being potty trained, when the parent might well say to you, "Oh, wonderful, what a well done, darling, lovely, you know, you're brilliant, you know, thank you so much," when you do your poop in the right place, and extravagantly respond to that fact. And so Freud thought there can be a link between excrement and gifts, which goes on into adult life. I mean, it's a bit in colloquialisms, you know, the word shit, if you'll excuse the four-letter word, is a colloquialism for money. And Freud thought there's a deep truth in that. But I think Dante was onto something similar, that the flatterers have got so used to wooing people by saying, "It's brilliant, it's fabulous, oh, it's perfect, I can't, you know, I can't believe you've produced this," and so on, that not just have they gaslighted the people they say all these things to all the time, but they've lost touch with the truth themselves. They've got so used to charming and seducing people that way that they've charmed and seduced themselves out of any touch with reality as well, and so find themselves, you know, up to their necks in it. It's that kind of, so it's not, again, they're sort of, they've become blind to the truth because of these habits that they trust and rely on and turn to at every trick and turn in their mortal lives that then gets amplified in the afterlife.
Yes, I see. Well, that makes it rather clearer. But I mean, there are all sorts of other people who are trapped in various ways. There's an area that you described, well, he calls them the bulges, a series of ditches with most of them have bridges over them, and that you have, and they look in, and each ditch has different kinds of people trapped in them. I mean, it's a kind of taxonomy of ways of being trapped. And perhaps you could just outline what they are. I mean, because it's an interesting taxonomy, that there's this particular region of the Inferno where there's a series of ditches. It's different from other regions.
Yeah, when they arrived there, Dante says there is a place called Malabolgia, you know, which is the place of the bad ditches. These kind of, they're not as big as valleys, but they're these circular grooves in the eighth circle of hell, where various of these characters, including the ones in excrement, can be found. And you're right, it is a kind of taxonomy, because Dante describes it as looking a bit like an amphitheater. But it also conjures up the sense that as he walks through and encounters these people, he can only do that because in some sense he's entered their state of mind. You know, as we said before, this is a sort of psychophysical space that you can traverse because you're not just exposed to it, but because you recognize or it activates something of those qualities in yourself. And so it is a bit like a map of the human psyche that they're traversing. I mean, it comes after a rather wonderful moment. And we talked before a bit about the walk across the hot sand. And when they come to the edge of that region, they need to get a ride on the back of a monster called Geryon, who takes them down into the place called Malabolgia. And Geryon, in a way, is a sort of summary of the whole area. There's a reason why you need to travel on the back of Geryon to get to this place, because Geryon has a human, smiling, charming face, a rather beautiful arabesque decorated back, but then has a scorpion's tail. And so it's the smile that has a sting in its tail, which again is, you know, kind of turn of phrase. That kind of duplicity very much marks a lot of the problems that people face in Malabolgia.
So, but the series of ditches in Malabolgia, what are the characteristics of those, if you could just summarize them briefly?
Yeah, so there's quite a lot. It's actually the longest section of the Inferno when they're traveling through Malabolgia. And it starts off with individuals like pimpers and seducers and flatterers, who you mentioned. There's very interesting encounters too, though, for Dante. So a couple to mention would be when they meet the diviners, and they are very memorable because they are having to walk forwards, but with their heads twisted round completely. So they're looking backwards. So the tears of their distress fall down their backs. And it's a really complicated encounter for Dante. It's one of the ones he finds most difficult, because in a way, he is a diviner. You know, he's telling the story of the future for us in the Divine Comedy. And he's trying to read the times as well in order to understand the implications of his times. And so he must, in a way, confront the risks of being a diviner, which I guess is when you become self-inflated, we might say now, that you mistake your ability to receive intimations of the present and the future as if as your own power, as if you had some kind of capacity to alter the future or to bend it to your will. And so I think that that's the significance of these diviners that he meets, and realizing that he has that possibility in himself is a crucial step, because then he can divine correctly. So it's worth just teasing that out a bit, because Dante's not saying I'm against divination, period. What he's saying is it's one of these gifts that is a divine gift, but which is very easy to become confused about and think that you are semi-divine yourself. And of course, you know, that is something which in the spiritual world is seen all the time when gurus become abusive and so on. So it's a very real danger. It was one for Dante. Another one that's in a similar vein for Dante is when they come to the Bolgia of lights, and in the lights they see souls trapped, these kind of flickering flames that are moving around the Bolgia. At first, to Dante, they look like fireflies, they look rather beautiful, but then he realizes that they are a bit more like mosquitoes and they would attack you. And in one of the lights, they meet the character of Ulysses or Odysseus. And the significance of that for Dante is that Odysseus too had traveled to the underworld and moreover had wanted to see all that human beings could possibly see, which of course is Dante's draw and even vocation as well. So he must encounter Ulysses to understand the mistakes that Ulysses had made. And one of the mistakes that becomes clear is that Ulysses too had kind of flattered his sailors, his men, to make an extra journey beyond the Pillars of Gibraltar, the Pillars of Hercules, into, you know, the world that was completely unknown outside of the Mediterranean, but had basically done it for narcissistic reasons, to celebrate his own power and capacity over others to persuade them to come with him, but also because he wanted to come close to the gods. And so, again, Dante must understand that subtle temptation, you know, even confusion, when you might try and woo others when they're not ready. And so because they're not ready to have their own perception, they therefore fall into your power. And so you become a god to them, if you like, And again, that is bad for them, but also for you. And so Ulysses ends up in one of these ditches as well. So I think Ulysses to learn that, actually, because I think another thing that becomes clear is that in the Bulgers is that not everybody is simply trapped. Ulysses seems to have some awareness of his mistake, and lights, you know, flames, even if they're burning and trapping in this instance, flames are never that far from the spirit and from rising to God. So there's always this subtlety going on with the Divine Comedy as well.
Yes. I mean, it's, a lot of these things are not obvious, are they? They're not. I mean, that's why it's so good to be able to read your commentary, because frankly, left to my own devices, I'd soon get lost. I mean, even with Virgil as the guide to Dante, I'd soon get lost. I definitely need you as an extra guide. But there's one where they're attacked by snakes and turn into snakes. Now, that again, I would have been hopelessly lost if I hadn't read your commentary. I wouldn't have known what was going on at all. So what is going on?
Yeah, so this is one of the most dramatic Bulger that they look into, and they see all these souls being chased by snakes and even dragons. And that looks sort of fearsome enough, but then they see the snakes kind of grabbing individuals. And then as the snakes become human, the humans they've grabbed turn into snakes. And so there's this metamorphosis going on. And you do wonder, you know, what on earth is all this sort of florid, extravagant kind of suffering all about? And I think it's particularly speaks to the Christian tradition, because what Dante intimates by the other allusions that he makes when he's describing that the sight is how different natures can relate. And this is a really crucial issue again for monotheists, because in the monotheistic vision, all things ultimately share in the divine nature, because the divine nature is their source, origin, and indeed their direction and return. And we human beings know that consciously with our sense and taste for the infinite and the eternal. But it's no straightforward thing to describe how mortal relates to immortality, or how the finite relates to infinitude. And again, you see very commonly in the spiritual world how people make mistakes about that. And so things can go very badly wrong. And I think that that's what this these ugly scenes between snakes and humans show. I mean, the snake has a lot of resonances, you know, for one. So the snake is the traditional tempter in the Garden of Eden. And Dante later finds out that the mistake of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden wasn't actually eating the fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, but it was eating it too soon. They sort of saw it and grabbed it and ate it, and then couldn't really tolerate what the fruit revealed to them. They, if you like, tried to awaken their divine side too speedily. And so the natures of the human and the divine couldn't commingle happily and expansively, and instead one destroyed the other. You know, there's quite a lot about this in different spiritual traditions, about how, you know, it's a fearsome thing to fall into the hands of the living God, would be a Hebrew way of putting it. In ancient Greek myth, there's stories like the story of Semele, who asked to see Jupiter. And Jupiter said, "You don't want to do this." And she said, "Yes, I do." And then she turns to ash. You know, so it's because we have a divine nature, because we're of the divine. That's not the same thing at all as saying, "So therefore, I can just wake up to that." It's in a way our whole life's journey. So I think there's something about that going on. And then, you know, more particularly, it's about the incarnation too in the Christian tradition of the focus on the person of Jesus as the human who lived, who was both fully human and fully transparent to the divine, and how you can understand that. So for Christianity, particularly the nature of Jesus, the two persons in one nature. So the two natures in one person, I should say, that's the correct formula, isn't it? You know, how we can actually know that is partly acted out negatively in this Bulger.
But I, what of the, I mean, the people who suffer this terrible fate? I mean, why is it that what they've done corresponds to this transformation into snakes, being eaten by snakes and becoming snakes? I mean, what have they actually done that for which that's an appropriate punishment or destiny?
Well, a lot of the figures in these lower reaches of hell have done the wrong things with money. They've either been, you know, fraudulent, or they've been con artists of various kinds, or they've been forgerers. And you do have to do a bit of work to understand why there's this sensitivity to money in Dante. But I think Dante is alert to it because he lives at the period where usury and so on, banking, mercantilism, financial markets and so on is just beginning to really take off and change the world in the so-called First Industrial Revolution. And the point about money, I think, is that money is creating something out of nothing. You know, money is just a token which we all agree to so that we can exchange stuff, you know, potentially for real things in the end of the day. You know, when you or I use money to go to the supermarket, we hand over a token and we get a pint of milk or something. But of course, in the world of banking, you are exchanging tokens for other tokens. And so you get into this setup where money makes money. And Dante is partly saying that that is a very dangerous game to get involved in, because before you know what's happened, you're under the illusion you can sort of do anything with money. You can create all sorts of worlds, and you have a power that's above the material and the natural world. Moreover, material life, which should speak to us of divine life, should be sacramental, should be always channeling and reflecting the divine light. You've repurposed the material world to reflect human light, mortal desire, kind of accumulative possessiveness. And so, you know, money is a very subtle and risky thing. And, you know, now, of course, it makes you think hard about how trapped we've become by money. You know, money promises security, and in a way it does deliver security, but it's very easy to lose touch with the real source of our security, which is our divine knowledge, our awareness of the true nature of reality and how to turn and rest on that. So I think there's a lot of that going on in these Bolger, where they meet figures who seem maybe in the first look to be over-punished for their attitude and what they did with money. But Dante's saying something very penetrating about a world ruled by usury, as indeed ours is now.
Yes, I mean, it's fascinating, really, all this emphasis on financial problems in that region of the Inferno, because, as you say, it's when money was just beginning to take on the power it now has. And money for its own sake, after all, cryptocurrencies and quantitative easing are the ultimate in this, aren't they, where money is no longer related to any actual goods. It's a purely fiat creation. I mean, someone just creates it from nothing. And then this comes to dominate the world, and it's what makes rich people very rich and powerful, most of it with quantitatively eased money. I mean, invented money almost always goes primarily to the rich, making them richer. So all that's very, very fascinating. And also, there's a point where you're discussing the treasurer of a church in, was it Florence or Pisa, who's embezzled or stolen money, that it's not just about stealing, your point that you're emphasizing. It's also, he got let someone else take the blame. So it's using this to do other people down, not simply to aggrandize himself.
Yeah, he's a figure who did steal, but actually, the reason why they're trapped in hell is because they got used to stealing as a way of life. And so they didn't just steal material stuff, but, you know, in particular, you might say he stole this innocent person's life in order to secure his own freedom. So the person that he accused took the punishment, went to prison, lost their life. And so you can say that he stole someone else's life in order to live, and, you know, didn't live his own life. And again, you know, that's actually a very consequential thing to deliberately do, to live a borrowed or stolen life. That's been noticed by many other people, because the point is, it means that your soul can't flourish in the way that it might if you choose to try and live someone else's path, or, you know, abandon your own path and live on someone else's back, you might say. Mm. You know, many people have noticed that. And again, it's quite a serious challenge now, because, you know, in a celebrity culture such as ours, it's very tempting to, if not actually want to be a celebrity, to kind of live virtually amidst their glamour and aura and light. But of course, that too is artificial. And so everybody gets caught up in this artificiality, and no one actually lives in touch with reality, which is so important for finding the way back to the true light, not just the glitzy glamour of celebrity and wealth.
Well, not just the true light, of course, but also living in harmony with the planet. I mean, that's an issue that Dante didn't really have to deal with, because at that stage of economic development, despoilation of the environment was actually an issue, but I mean, it wasn't something that was a major part of people's consciousness.
Yeah, no, that's sorry, did you want to say more on that?
No, I was just making the point that, you know, that these things, they're about other people, they're about money, and they're about other people. There's very little I've come across in your account of the Inferno, which is to do with despoiling nature. Whereas if there were a current version of the Inferno, then I'm quite sure that some of the people in the lower depths would be those who deliberately despoil, you know, just cut down vast areas of forest for private profit, or even sort of, you know, willfully destroy the environment, overfish the seas, etc. All of us are guilty of it, in the sense that we all benefit from these terrible depredations of the environment. But some are more instrumental in it than others. But these are a whole set of issues that Dante didn't have to deal with.
Yeah, no, you're right about that. I mean, there are myths that already touch on the effects of that. So there's a story of, I forget his name now, but a chap who cut down a grove that was sacred to a goddess, and purely for his own sort of self-aggrandizement and consumer needs, to build himself a fabulous palace or something. I can't quite remember all the details. But anyway, the point is that the goddess punishes him by making his ravenous hunger to consume everything go out of control. And so eventually he ends up eating his family and then eats himself. And, you know, so you don't have to work too hard at that kind of myth to get the point about consumption. But maybe what is in Dante, which is our loss too, although people are trying to address this, not least Merlin, your son, in his wonderful book, Entangled Life, is how we can learn from nature. And it's a very powerful theme, particularly in the Purgatory, how reflecting on nature and its ways is to reflect on God and divine ways as well. And this is both a very common cosmological reflection in the Purgatory, by looking at the heavens, but also by considering things like trees, which happens quite a lot in Purgatory. So that's the double loss, really. It's not just consuming and despoiling nature, but it's missing out on how nature is on our side in terms of our spiritual journey.
Yes. Well, as we proceed down, the final stage is this giant lifts them down to the very floor of the Inferno, which is not an inferno at all, but which is frozen, which is very cold. And so the basis of the whole thing is very surprising, really. You mentioned this in our last conversation, but this is the floor of the Inferno, the bottom of the bottomed pit. It's not a bottomless pit, it's got a bottom, and the bottom is frozen, with Lucifer, a kind of frozen Lucifer lying there. This is very surprising, and at least came as a shock to me.
Yeah, it's it draws from the Neoplatonic stroke Christian understanding of the nature of evil as not an equal and opposite force to good, but as a lack of goodness. And so this shows up in Dante's perception as reality itself becoming frozen, i.e. lacking life and vitality, almost to the point of falling out of existence altogether. And so it gets colder and colder. There's a kind of absolute zero, if you like, at which point something couldn't exist at all. And so that's what shows up in these, you know, the deepest parts of hell. But what's also so interesting is that a lot of the figures they meet there were ostensibly quite close to God. So there's a different kind of risk for the spiritual seeker and journeyer that shows up in this last part of hell. I mean, the obvious person that was very close to God was Lucifer himself, who was a seraph, and the angels, which are said to be closest to the divine. Of course, Lucifer means the creature of light. And Dante later learns that what Lucifer couldn't tolerate was knowing about divine life, knowing about the nature of reality, but not possessing it. And so having to live in a relationship with all things that constantly gave all things away in order to enjoy all things. And this is summarizing William Blake's wonderful phrase, which I've no doubt said before, the difference between binding to yourself the joy and kissing the joy as it flies. Blake was very clear that kissing the joy as it flies is to live in eternity's sunrise. So Lucifer makes that mistake, and it leads to a terrible fall because of the great heights, if you like, that he did enjoy. And the figure who is also with Lucifer that they meet is Judas. At least they don't meet Judas, because Judas can't really communicate to them, but Judas is being chewed in one of Lucifer's mauls and raked down the back and so on. And again, it's really fascinating to ask why Judas. And I think that this is a reflection in the Christian tradition on how, in a way, Judas perhaps was the disciple closest to Jesus. He's the one disciple that is said to kiss Jesus. There's this sense that he was entrusted with much, perhaps because Jesus realized he understood much. In a way, because he was so close to the divine vision, was also at the greatest risk of losing it all, and so makes this mistake that then in the tradition gets very amplified. People have written about this and about how the very earliest traditions of Judas didn't see Judas as the Judas figure quite as much as became. But nonetheless, there's a deep truth, I think, in this, that the more you aspire to know about these things, the more you have to die to yourself in order to be able to exist with that knowledge. It's a real truth, I think, that it's so easy to speak about wonderful divine things and get confused about your own status, feeling, you know, adulated, or is it inflated, not, as it were, honoring God in what's being talked about and shared and communicated. That's part of what's going on. That's not just people getting condemned to the lower reaches of hell, frozen in a lake, but why there's something really, again, very subtle that Dante has to see before he can begin the ascent up purgatory and into paradise. He must understand those risks for himself in order to be able to continue on the journey.
And he does continue, doesn't he? I mean, I was very surprised at the ending where, as he continues on the journey, instead of going up, which is what one might expect, he goes further down. And that's the beginning of climbing Mount Purgatory, which is the next stage. And it's as if he's going to Australia, as it were, and ascending a mountain there. It's sort of like when I was a child, I always used to think, you know, if I dug a hole deep enough, would I come up in Australia? And so there he is in the depths of the earth. And by going down, he's going to come up in the base of Mount Purgatory. I mean, Dante didn't know about Australia, of course, but that was what came to my mind.
Yeah, no, although he did know about the Southern Hemisphere, actually, because when they appear on Mount Purgatory, they are in the Southern Hemisphere. For example, he sees the four stars of the Southern Cross in the sky. But this is a mythological geography as well. It's this psychophysical space. And whilst in one way Dante imagines coming to the centre of the earth and there being a moment where you realise that you're not climbing down anymore, you've actually begun to climb up. So Dante knew the earth was a globe, for example. It's one of these great myths of the modern world that everyone thought the earth was flat. That's not true at all. But really what Dante's doing is making more of a spiritual point with the mythology. Part of the story is that the reason why Lucifer's in the centre of the earth is because when Lucifer fell from heaven, nature, matter, fled from before Lucifer as Lucifer fell. You know, nature itself, matter itself, abhorred what had happened, and so fled even as Lucifer fell. And so Lucifer ends up at the point where there's no matter to flee from him anymore, which is the center of the earth. But then all that gets moved by Lucifer's fall becomes Mount Purgatory on the other side of the globe. So the myth here is trying to say that even the most terrible event in spiritual history, in salvation time, becomes the means back to the divine. It is the making of the path back to the divine, even as it was the fall from the divine as well. And so that's one of these amazing themes that's so embedded in the Divine Comedy, that descent and ascent are so intimately linked.
Very fascinating, Mark. Well, in our next conversation, or at least sometime in the future, I hope we'll be able to move on to purgatory as the next phase and discuss this process of ascent.
Yeah, well, I'll hold you to it, because one of the things that I'm really keen on is that people find a way into the purgatory and the paradise, because we, you know, live in an age where a lot of people would say, you know, they kind of get the inferno but aren't sure about the other things. But the whole point is it's a journey to God. It's not just, I was going to say it's not just about the condemnation of souls in hell. I think you start to see why even those souls that look to be perpetually trapped in hell aren't going to be. That it shows how Christianity is a universal religion. All will be saved, to use the words of St. Paul. But without being glib about the seriousness that people can find themselves in. And that's why I think Dante has to do this descent first of all.
Fascinating. Well, I much look forward to first reading it and second discussing it with you. So thank you very much for the journey so far.
Yeah, and thank you for the enthusiasm for inviting me to speak about these things with your prompts. I do appreciate it. Thank you.